Good morning. I'm very pleased to be part of today's agenda, one which is vastly different from that of 3 years ago when the Rappaport Center and the New England Public Policy Center hosted a joint conference here on housing affordability. Although maybe not so different, since we're still trying to answer the same question, which is, why did house prices rise so rapidly during the middle of the last decade? And apparently this is not a straightforward question because we're still here 3 years later scratching our heads and trying to answer it. I think this chart captures the essence of what we're hoping to better understand here today. It's a familiar picture to many of you in the audience, or at least one that you might easily conjure from hearing reports in the media and elsewhere over the past several years. But as striking as this chart might be, the statistics that lie behind it are even more dramatic. Between 1995 and 2005, real single-family house prices rose an average of 6.2% per year in New England and 4.1% per year nationwide. Much of the increase occurred in the latter part of this period as the growth in house prices accelerated after 2000. At the height of the housing boom, prices were rising roughly 7% in 2005 alone. And although Boston led the way in New England, metro areas around the region followed suit. And so we saw prices rising dramatically over this period from Portland, Maine, all the way down to Providence, Rhode Island. Even metro areas like Burlington, Vermont, and Hartford, Connecticut, which saw price increases more in line with the national experience, saw prices rising by 5% per year as they approached the peak. And then, of course, everything changed. But before I get to that, I'd like to talk a little bit about what was happening during the boom leading up to this crisis and what we'll be discussing in a little more detail as the day progresses. One of the things that was unprecedented about this housing boom was that it encompassed virtually all regions of the country. Many of you in the audience will probably remember the last housing boom in New England, but that was really a regional phenomenon that was limited to the Northeast and California. This time around, prices were rising rapidly in many cities across the country, from the usual suspects like San Francisco, New York, and Boston, to other markets like Milwaukee, Atlanta, Phoenix, Las Vegas. However, the magnitude and the timing of these increases differed across different cities. So cities like Vegas and Phoenix saw a dramatic spike and then drop in prices. Places like San Francisco and other cities in California saw prices explode, but they didn't see as much of a downturn afterwards. Cities like New York and Boston did experience a run-up in prices, but not as dramatic as the first two groups. And Boston actually peaked much earlier than the rest of the nation, about a year before the national peak in 2006. And then finally, cities like Milwaukee and Atlanta had more gradual price increases than cities on the coast. So the big question is, why did house prices increase so rapidly during the middle of the last decade? Today you'll hear from two of my esteemed colleagues, Ed Glaser and Paul Willen, about three potential explanations. First, some suggest that low and declining mortgage interest rates played a major role in pushing up housing demand throughout the nation during this period. Second, others blame it on bad lending promoted by the securitization of mortgages, where mortgage intermediaries had little incentive to adequately screen mortgage applicants. And third, what is kind of the no-fault explanation here, I guess, prices increased simply because people expected them to increase. In other words, we experienced a true housing bubble. So let's look at some circumstantial evidence leading up to the housing bust. First off, as Eric pointed out, short-term mortgage rates did fall sharply immediately after the 2001 recession. But the drop in the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, so that's the blue line there, was not as steep, which leaves open the question of whether the decline in mortgage rates was really large enough to spur such a rapid increase in prices. Moreover, while interest rates may explain movements in house prices over time, they don't explain differences in appreciation across states or metro areas, suggesting that there's likely other factors that are affecting prices independently of interest rates. So we'll hear more about this debate from Ed Glaser in a minute when he answers the question of whether credit market policies caused the housing bubble. Our second explanation points the finger at the securitization process for encouraging bad lending on the part of brokers who had little skin in the game if the loans went sour. But if bad lending was so pervasive, then why was the share of mortgages with high loan-to-value ratios falling? Coming up with a down payment is one of the most important borrowing constraints for a home buyer. Anybody knows this in buying a house, particularly for buyers who are at the lower end of the spectrum, where you find most first-time home buyers and others with limited means. If households were making smaller initial down payments, then we would expect the share of mortgages with high loan-to-value ratios to be rising over time. Instead, the share was decreasing through 2005. In addition, it's questionable whether investors in mortgage-backed securities were so completely unaware about the quality of the mortgages that they were buying. Paul Willen's going to show us later this morning the vast amounts of information that were available regarding the mortgages underlying those securities. Finally, perhaps the least satisfying or at least the hardest explanation to pin down is that prices rose because we are indeed in a true housing bubble. The term bubble is used widely, but not defined very clearly. Rapid price increases in and of themselves are not enough to define a bubble. The basic question is whether irrational expectations about future price increases are driving prices to be temporarily high today. In other words, did house prices simply rise because people expected them to rise? During a bubble, home buyers think that a home that would normally be considered too expensive for them is now an acceptable purchase because they'll be compensated by significant future price increases. For example, first-time home buyers might worry that if they don't buy it now, they won't be able to afford a house in the future. A survey done by Chip Case and Robert Schiller in 2003 shows that folks were certainly exhibiting bubble-like behavior. Nearly 40% of single-family home buyers in Boston reported that they felt pressured to buy now lest they be priced out of the market, and 30% said they had been influenced by all the excitement surrounding the recent house price changes. Note that these responses were not as strong as they were in 1988, at least in San Francisco and Boston, when Case and Schiller did this survey at the height of the last housing boom. However, the sense of excitement was elevated in 2003 in Milwaukee, a city that had never experienced a housing bubble before. How high were expectations in 2003? Although short-term expectations were not as high as they were in 1988, long-term expectations reveal that people believed prices would continue to rise pretty much indefinitely. In the 12 months after buying their home, respondents in 2003 expected house prices to increase by 6 to 7%. And in large measure, they weren't off too much because prices continued to increase at this rate through 2004 and 2005. But folks also expected their properties to appreciate through the coming decade after their purchase, on the order of 12 to 16% per year. I don't usually like to forecast prices, particularly house prices, and certainly not 10 years in advance, but I could say it would take an act of God to see any kind of appreciation like that by 2013. Moreover, these high long-term expectations were present in 2003 in all three of our cities, again, including Milwaukee, which had never seen a bubble before. Why were expectations so high? Well, it's hard to say, but again, Case and Schiller give us some insight as to what home buyers were thinking. One defining characteristic of a bubble is a tendency for buyers to view housing as an investment rather than as a consumption good. In 2003, the majority of home buyers in San Francisco and Milwaukee and over a third of home buyers in Boston said that thinking about their home as an investment was a major consideration in their decision to purchase. Another 55% in Boston said that the investment motive was at least part of their reason for purchasing. So in all three markets, about three-quarters of home buyers were thinking about their homes as an investment. Moreover, if you're expecting double-digit appreciation over the next decade, then housing looks like a pretty safe bet. So we'll hear more about this irrational expectations explanation from Paul Willen later in the morning. As we know, of course, the rapid rise in house prices reversed itself in 2006. Since 2006, real single-family house prices have fallen 4.8% per year in New England and 3.6% per year nationally. Recently, we've begun to see some tentative signs of improvements in some metro areas. For example, for the first time since December 2006, the annual rates of change in the Case and Shiller composite indexes were positive as of February. Price appreciation in Boston was slightly higher than the composite 10 index, with prices up about 1.8% over a year ago. But lest we get ahead of ourselves, 11 of the 20 composite cities, they're not all listed here, showed signs of improvement, but still experienced year-over-year price declines. And you can see that in some of the cities that are listed, most notably Las Vegas, which is still down 15% year-over-year. And also in other places, Miami, New York, Chicago, and Charlotte. The monthly numbers, which aren't shown here, also signal some signs of caution, as more than half of the 20 MSAs that are in the composite index showed a price decline between January and February. The foreclosure data also show little sign of optimism as of yet. The good news is that, aside from Rhode Island, most New England states are faring better than the nation during the foreclosure crisis. In contrast, metro areas in other parts of the country, such as California, Florida, Nevada, and Arizona, are some of the hardest hit. The bad news is that although foreclosures appeared to have reversed course at the end of 2009, according to this chart, more recent data at the national level shows that the U.S. Foreclosure rate, the total rate of foreclosures for the country, actually increased in the first quarter of this year. This upward trend here in seriously delinquent mortgages echoes this concern. As these homes are put up for sale in the coming months, there's likely to be some further dampening of home prices. And in addition, the majority of foreclosures that were due to subprime lending have pretty much been resolved by now. And so what's driving this current picture in terms of delinquencies and foreclosures is other factors, namely the high rate of job loss. And so that's what's kind of the issue today. And the foreclosure crisis is no longer limited to subprime loans. The rate of foreclosure on prime loans, so even the 30-year fixed-rate products that people thought were the safest, has been rising since 2007. And even though the foreclosure rate is less than 1% on these 30-year fixed-rate loans, because they make up the majority of mortgages, they actually are now making up the majority of foreclosures out there. Now, some have suggested that the silver lining to this housing crisis is that there would be an increase in affordability, certainly a problem that had plagued New England just a few years ago. A new discussion paper by Robert Clifford of the New England Public Policy Center shows that as house prices have fallen, affordability has indeed improved. So if you see there that dark line going across is our threshold of affordability. Here we're looking at the ratio of real annual household income to the annual income needed to purchase the median-priced house. So a ratio of less than one means that housing is unaffordable. And as you can see, Boston is that red line there. We dipped down below the affordability threshold just after 2000, and now we have just returned to the affordability threshold. But you can also see on this chart that New England and Boston are not unique in this regard. So concurrent price declines nationwide in other metro areas have continued to make owner-occupied housing more affordable in other places. So in other words, even though the median-priced house or the median household can now afford to buy the median-priced house in Boston, they can get more bang for their buck in other places, so cities like D.C. and Chicago, Raleigh, North Carolina. Moreover, there's a dark cloud to the silver lining. So although housing appears to be more affordable, few households are in a position to take advantage of this situation. A large number of households, both in New England and across the nation, entered the recession already burdened by high housing costs, which didn't get any easier as folks lost their jobs. In both New England and the U.S., the percentage of middle-income households experiencing a moderate or a severe housing burden, so here we're defining that as if the household spends more than 30% of their income on housing, so the rate of burden increased through 2007, and as of 2008, middle-income homeowners in New England, roughly a third of them were burdened compared to only 25% nationwide. Looking forward, we've seen some improvement in terms of looking at existing and new home sales, inventories, and housing starts, especially in March. But as Eric already mentioned, the home buyer tax credit's likely a factor in a lot of this encouraging data. And there's some concern as to what the level of sales will be once the credit has expired. Estimates from the Warren Group suggest that as much as 60% of the housing market in Massachusetts has been buoyed by this tax credit. So the expiration of the credit, along with rising mortgage rates and some tightening of lending on the part of the FHA, could mean that the recent momentum that we've seen in the housing market will peter out by the end of the summer as those deals close. In addition, the labor market continues to lag behind other economic activity, further straining household resources, although there have been some positive signs of job creation. In New England, the labor market added jobs for the third straight month as of March, and you can see the unemployment rate ticked down ever so slightly up there. In addition, online job postings were up in the region, over 20% compared to last year, but initial claims for unemployment insurance, which had been declining for seven straight months in a row, and are significantly better than last year, just ticked up for the first time again in March. So clearly we are by no means out of the woods. And the question now is, where do we go from here? And hopefully today that's what we're going to shed some light on. Hopefully looking back on this period will allow us to identify the factors that played a role in the housing crisis and help policymakers think more clearly about what regulations and safeguards should be put in place going forward. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Ed.